Could a computer capable of learning figure out a fire's overall behavior based on the conditions when and where it starts? In many cases, yes. Let's get the more comprehensive answer from the lead researcher. That is Shane Caulfield, who's a doctoral student in Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Shane, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Let's start with the training wheels on. Machine learning, which is what you used here, is one kind of artificial intelligence. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, so I think artificial intelligence is kind of the umbrella term that usually broadly refers to machines mimicking, usually like human cognitive abilities by trying to learn or solve problems. It's used a lot for speech and image recognition problems. But in our case, we use machine learning, which basically just refers to a computer's ability to identify patterns. And specifically, we evaluated a few different machine learning methods and settled on one that's one of the simplest. It's called a decision tree, and it's really just about training the computer to identify which combinations of variables are really important for predicting final fire size from the time of ignition.
I'm glad you brought decision trees up now. So when we talk about decision trees, these are not trees as in forests. These are trees that have different branches of decision upon them.
Right, exactly. And it's confusing because there's decision trees, and a group of decision trees is called a random forest.
Uh-huh.
It has nothing to do with, you know, the trees or the forests that are burning. It's an algorithm that has branches, that's why it's called a tree, and basically you can follow that tree based on the current conditions, whatever combination of humidity and temperature and vegetation are in the area, and ultimately end up at a leaf node on that tree, which is your final decision or the classification as a small, a medium, or a large fire.
So you chose Alaska for this research, and talk about why you chose there and about the effects that climate change is having on these northern or boreal forests.
Sure. So we chose Alaska mostly because of what you're saying. It's an area that's really been impacted by climate change. It's warming at about twice the rate of the global average, and that's had a huge impact on the forests. The summers have been longer and hotter. And what's really important is that there's been an increase in lightning strikes in the area. And it's, you know, typically the fires are limited by lightning strikes there. And so what happens is these storms can come through in the summer and ignite dozens of fires across the interior part of the state in just a few days. And that's, you know, a really challenging problem for fire managers. Historically, they haven't tried to fight a lot of the fires that are out in the wilderness, if they're not too close to populated areas. But one of the points we make in the paper is that these fires are becoming so frequent that they're really starting to harm the ecosystems, which aren't adapted to the modern fire frequency. And so it might be in sort of our best interest to start fighting some of those, at least to be able to pick out the largest ones to send resources to and prevent a lot of the destruction and the smoke, too, which has been affecting cities.
I see your point that there was obviously fire in the ecosystem and some lightning, but this is a lot more lightning than was there before.
Exactly.
All right. So it sounds like we're talking about an area where humans would be challenged and have been challenged to make predictions about fire behavior based on changing conditions.
Right.
Shane Caulfield's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a doctoral student at the University of California, Irvine, and the lead author of a paper called Machine Learning to Predict Final Fire Size at the Time of Ignition, which sounds wonderful. Wouldn't it be great to know when a fire starts, how big it might get, and make some decisions about firefighting at that point? There is some success with this machine learning, as we're hearing. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Shane, it seems like you'd have some serious choices to make in which conditions to track. Talk about that process, your own decision tree, as it were, about what to include.
Sure. This is one of the cases where machine learning really comes in handy because we can come up with a huge list of variables, not really knowing what's going to be important. So it's any combination of vegetation and topography and weather, and weather at different time scales, too. We don't know if it's, you know, is it a week before that's really important, or the day of, or a few days in the future? And so all these different combinations, and we can feed that into different models in machine learning, and it can help identify what are the critical time periods and the critical combinations of just a few variables. And so that's what helped us to pick out It's really just two key things. One is called the vapor pressure deficit. It's basically just how dry the air is over the next few days. And the other is the fraction of spruce trees in about a 2.5 mile radius around the ignition. So that's something that machine learning helped us with.
Aside from those conditions, I do want to get into those further. I just wonder if there's a body of work that you could take into the machine learning that says, for example, vegetation is 35% of the picture unless the slope is greater than 20%, or some combination of factors like that.
Oh, right. Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of research on that already, and that's how we knew as a starting point, and we fine-tuned that with machine learning.
Okay, so we have the space, we have variables. Add time. How big a set of years did you consider? You're looking basically at fires that had already happened, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, this is all trained on historical fire data. Our data set, we started at 2001 based on when there was some satellite data available as sort of a validation. So we used 2001 to 2017, and that's a data set of about 1,200 fires.
That's a bunch. So you track them all basically from ignition to conclusion?
Correct. So basically the training data we had was the location of the ignition, use that to find things like weather and vegetation, and then just the final fire size, whether it was, we used a classification of small, medium, and large.
Okay, so you did case studies essentially, and then you were mentioning that the two major factors seem to be vapor pressure deficit, how dry the area is, and spruce trees. Now we're talking about black spruce. This is present in much of the study area in Alaska. Does it have this tree some particular features that make it susceptible to fire?
Sure. Yeah, it's really well adapted to fire and its ecosystem, and it's actually what's called a fire embracer. So we have trees that are fire resistors, like the ponderosa pine in California, but the black spruce actually kind of has these long branches, and it wicks up the fire and tries to spread it, basically to kill everything else out, and it can survive through the fire.
So black spruce will basically welcome the fire, and then but in a more southerly forest without black spruce, are the conditions then very different?
Sure, yeah. And are you referring to something like here in California or Oregon?
Yes.
Yeah, so obviously the tree species are different, and that's something we're interested in doing is we can use the same approach, but kind of retrain the model for a different area, and I'm sure we would find that there are different species that are really important, and it's probably likely that the temperature and the wind are going to be the really key variables in places like California, because we get these, this combination of hot and dry and windy that can really let a fire get out of control.
All right, so different sorts of conditions than are present in the study area in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So how well did the machine learning do then? I mean, give us a sense of how much you put all 1,200 fires in, and did it make pretty accurate predictions on how those fires would end up?
Right.
Basically, did you not reveal the ending to the machine learning and let it figure it out?
So essentially what we're doing is we're trying to classify into three size groups. That's like a 1 in 3 chance, right? And we turned that into basically a coin flip. So our accuracy was 50%, which kind of doesn't really seem like much. But the reason we still thought it was interesting and promising and published a paper on it is for a couple reasons. It's particularly accurate for the largest fires, which are the really important ones. So it can catch about 65% of those largest fires. And even that difference, like getting the 50% accuracy, is still enough information to be able to do some triaging, just because it's really a few fires that are accounting for a majority of the burned area. So we have a figure we can show. If you want to prevent like 80% of the burned area, you only need to fight 40% of the fires identified by our model.
So in essence, we're talking a chance for firefighters and fire managers really to do tabletop triage to decide which fires to put crews and aircraft on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's imperfect information, but it's really fast and, right, really just focused on this kind of triaging situation.
So the experiment then was primarily entirely with fires that have already happened. So when you think about potentially using this in future applications, how quickly would some of the basic information have to be entered, or how quickly would data have to be available to the machine learning to be able to spit out a prediction?
Sure. So I'll say first, it is. When we train it on historical data, there's also a validation process we do. We'll train on like 90% of the data and then test it on the remaining 10% and kind of alternate through every possible combination of holding out subsets of data. So it's really that 50% that we're reporting is really already well validated on, you know, new fires that the model hadn't seen when it was developed. But in terms of future fires, the idea is that it would be really simple and fast, and it could, you know, maybe a web-based tool where all you need is the ignition location, and it would automatically pull in like the real-time weather and have a preloaded vegetation map so that it could make decisions instantaneously for a lot of fires at once.
In this study area in Alaska, how varied was the terrain? I mean, I wonder about challenges in trying to apply this in other places, for example, California in particular, which has so many different types of terrain and so many different vegetation groups and ecosystems.
Definitely. I think the topography would be a little bit more challenging in California. We found the topography wasn't really significant in our model, probably just because of the simplistic approach we took. And a lot of the biggest fires happen in kind of this low-lying area. But definitely that's something to account for going forward.
Shane Caulfield, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about an experiment, research that he led with a number of other researchers about using machine learning, artificial intelligence, to predict fires based on the conditions at the time and place of ignition. The paper is called Machine Learning to Predict Final Fire Size at the Time of Ignition, published in the International Journal of Wildland Fire this month. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. In terms of other things that existed in the study area in Alaska, talk about human habitation. You mentioned wilderness. Is this a largely unpopulated area?
Right. That's one of the things that makes Alaska really interesting. There are different, what they call fire suppression zones. So areas that are near human-populated areas are, you know, if it's really close to a city, they suppress all the fires, and that's considered a critical zone. And we, for our study, we were interested in the scientific question of how is climate controlling fires. And so we chose to only focus on fires that are out in the wilderness where there is really, really limited suppression. That's about 70% of all the fires that happen out in the wilderness where humans aren't controlling them. And that is also an area where it's kind of the biggest open question going forward. If we do want to start suppressing fires, how should we do it?
So I noticed this was published in the middle of September, so it's been out there for long enough probably to people have a chance to read it and to get some responses to it. I wonder what you're hearing back from firefighters, if any, so far, or firefighting managers.
Sure, a little bit. It's, I think, gotten more attention than I anticipated, but we have heard back from the Alaska Fire Consortium, and they've picked up some interest in the work we're doing, and we'll probably, the goal is to be working with them going forward, probably with presenting maybe in a webinar or something this fall. They're kind of still wrapping up their fire season, and they've been really busy with that, but I think we're looking forward to collaborating over the winter and spring before summer starts up again with them. So I'll be really interested to hear their thoughts on this based on, you know, their expertise having been on the ground in that area.
Well, it certainly seems to bear some promise, and that would be sort of a dream for anybody trying to make decisions about how to allocate resources for fires to be able to say, okay, this one, and this one are the ones that get attention right now. We'll deal with the others later. But, I mean, are we still talking a long road ahead to get to that point?
I think so. It's you know, the model is already up and developed, so in that sense, most of the work is done. What would be left at this point is if they do decide that this is something really promising, you know, there's a lot more research we can do to try to get the accuracy a little bit higher. But the other component of this is developing it into a tool, something probably that would be on the web or an application that they can use and just kind of drop in the coordinates to get a prediction. So right now it's, you know, kind of the model that we have on paper, but there's that step of turning it into a tool.
Were there any particular surprises along the way, things that you hadn't anticipated coming out of the data, either the stuff you picked up on the ground and gave into the machine learning system or what the system gave you back?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think what was surprising is that we could even get the accuracy that we're getting just with a couple of variables. Really, it's this vapor pressure deficit that's so significant, and I find it surprising that just knowing that for the first couple days of a fire can really determine if that fire is able to get sort of big enough quickly that it can sustain itself maybe through wetter periods. These are fires that can burn for weeks or months, so to think that there's really predictive information just in the first couple days is pretty interesting. And the other thing I'll say is that we found that the more complicated answer isn't always the better one. And fire prediction is a really complicated problem, but we tried a lot of different types of machine learning and found that the more complex kind of neural networks that we tried didn't outperform the simplest and most easy to interpret method, which was the decision tree. And that might be because we're using kind of simple data inputs, but I guess the lesson learned is that you should do things kind of as simply as possible, but not simpler, as Einstein would say.
Right. That sounds like something our parents told us, too.
Yeah.
Shane, where do you go from here? Is there another round of research that builds upon this in the works?
Mm-hmm. I think where we're going now is kind of shifting gears to California, because that's where a lot of the interest has been. You know, we live here, and we've seen how devastating the fires have been in the last few years. And this has been a really, really expensive problem for the state, and they're really strapped on resources. I think focusing our attention down here now.
Okay, certainly welcome if it does bear the same sorts of results you got from Alaska. The paper's called Machine Learning to Predict Final Fire Size at the Time of Ignition. Shane Caulfield at the University of California, Irvine, a doctoral student in Earth System Science, the lead author. Also Casey Graff, Yang Chen, Padraig Smith, Eli Fufula Georgiou, and James Randerson also on the research. Thank you so much, Shane, for talking with us today, and the best of luck in moving this into a land closer to home where it bears some promise.
Right. Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering science research on your show.
Glad to do it. Bottom of the hour on the Jefferson Exchange. Let us check in with today's edition of Marketplace Tech.
Universal Basic Data Income. It's not just an idea. There's an app for that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech, demystifying the digital economy. I'm Molly Wood.
Marketplace Tech is supported by HomeAdvisor, helping homeowners find local pros for their home projects. Homeowners can get matched to pros, read reviews, and check cost guides at HomeAdvisor.com. And by ADP, focused on transforming how work gets done with HR, talent, time, benefits, and payroll, informed by data and designed for people. ADP, always designing for people.
Okay, so when it comes to trading your data for free services like Facebook or Google Search or Gmail or Twitter, are you getting a fair deal? Well, a growing roster of people say no, and you should be paid for your personal information. But so far, no one's quite figured out how that could work. One startup is working on it. Two startups, actually. Digime, spelled like Digime, is an app that lets you connect all your various online accounts. And it scoops up all the data they have on you and puts it in one encrypted location that you can control. And then a new company called Ubdi can, with your permission, pay you to share some of that data with companies or researchers. I know, you have questions. Dana Budzin is co-founder and CEO of Ubdi. Get it? UBDI, Universal Basic Data Income. First, I asked her how it works.
We do allow individuals to aggregate their own data across different applications and accounts, like Fitbit, Spotify, credit cards, Instagram, etc. And then we give these people a vehicle to basically share anonymized insights from that data with paying companies and researchers and nonprofits. So with our application, we present individuals with different studies. Once you've linked your accounts, you're able to click in, view the details. It may include a question of a survey, which people are familiar with. It'll tell you, you know, Spotify, listening to certain tracks, or we're looking at finance and we're looking at coffee trends. So we want to analyze Starbucks or Pete's coffee spending, whatever it may be. And then you swipe to consent, and that data is anonymized on your device, aggregated in the back end, and shared with researchers who obviously are paying you.
How then do you protect that data? Obviously, you're talking about a pretty big treasure trove here.
Right. So our partner DigiMe, they don't see, touch, or hold the data. They give you the only key to access this and then allow you to share that data with apps like ours when you choose. Mm. It's actually a two-app system, which is very non-traditional. And what it allows us to do is do a lot of edge processing and analytics on the device. So we're minimizing any of the data that leaves your device. And then what we call tags, it's called private match, right? These things that I've mentioned, you're a runner, you're a skier, you're a female, right? That's all kept on your device. So neither us at Ubdi or any of our partners know who you are. And we ensure that no profiles are being built on people.
And then just on the purely mercenary side of things, how much do you expect that a consumer could make participating with Ubdi?
I think for some people, it will be hundreds. I think for many people, it will be thousands. And then I think there will be other communities of people. Maybe it's in the future of medical data or whatever it is, some special things about you that make you unique, that thousands upon thousands of dollars, maybe 5 to 10,000.
Dana Budson is CEO and co-founder of Ubdi. Still have questions? Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Podcast to hear more of our conversation wherever you like to download. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.